A PDF with Stephen King's foreword accompanies this program. Simon & Schuster Audio presents Gwendy's Magic Feather, a novella by Richard Chismar, read by Maggie Siff.
For Kara, Billy, and Noah, the magic in my life. 1. On Thursday, December 16th, 1999, Gwendy Peterson wakes up before the sun, dresses in layers for the cold, and heads out for a run. Once upon a time, she walked with a slight limp thanks to an injury to her right foot. But 6 months of physical therapy and orthotic inserts in her favorite New Balance running shoes took care of that little problem. Now she runs at least 3 or 4 times a week, preferably at dawn, as the city is just beginning to open its eyes. An awful lot has happened in the 15 years since Gwendy graduated from Brown University and moved away from her hometown of Castle Rock, Maine. But there's plenty of time to tell that story. For now, let's tag along as she makes her way crosstown. After stretching her legs on the concrete steps of her rented townhouse, Gwendy jogs down 9th Street, her feet slapping a steady rhythm on the salted roadway, until it runs into Pennsylvania Avenue. She hangs a sharp left and cruises past the Navy Memorial and the National Gallery of Art. Even in the heart of winter, the museums are well illuminated, the gravel and asphalt walkways shoveled clean, our tax dollars hard at work. Once Gwendy reaches the mall, she notches it up a gear, feeling the lightness in her feet and the power in her legs. Her ponytail peeks out from underneath her winter cap, rustling against the back of her sweatshirt with every step she takes. She runs along the reflecting pool, missing the families of ducks and birds that make it their home during the warm summer months, toward the obelisk shadow of the Washington Monument. She stays on the lighted path, swinging a wide circle around the famous landmark, and heads east toward the Capitol building. The Smithsonian Museums line both sides of the mall here, and she remembers the first time she visited Washington, D.C. She was 10 that summer, and she and her parents spent 3 long, sweaty days exploring the city from dawn to dusk. At the end of each day, they collapsed on their hotel beds and ordered room service, an unheard-of luxury for the Peterson family, because they were too exhausted to shower and venture out for dinner. On their final morning, her father surprised the family with tickets to one of the city's pedicab tours. The 3 of them squeezed into the back of the cramped carriage, eating ice cream cones and giggling as their tour guide peddled them around the mall. Never in a million years did Gwendy dream she'd one day live and work in the nation's capital. If anyone questioned her of that likelihood, even 18 months earlier, her answer would have been a resounding no. Life is funny that way, she thinks, cutting across a gravel pathway in the direction of 9th Street. Full of surprises, and not all of them good. Leaving the mall behind, Gwendy pulls frigid air into her lungs and quickens her stride for the final home stretch. The streets are alive now, bustling with early morning commuters, homeless people emerging from their cardboard boxes, and the rumble and grind of garbage trucks making their rounds. Gwendy spots the multicolored Christmas lights twinkling from her bay window ahead and takes off in a sprint. Her neighbor across the street lifts a hand and calls out to her, but Gwendy doesn't see or hear. Her legs flex with fluid grace and strength, but her mind is far away this cold December morning. Two. Even with damp hair and barely a hint of makeup on her face, Gwendy is gorgeous. She draws a number of appreciative, not to mention a few openly envious, stares as she stands in the corner of the cramped elevator. Were her old friend Olive Kepnes still alive, even after all these years, Gwendy still thinks of her almost every day. Olive would tell Gwendy that she looked like a million bucks and change, and she would be right. dressed in plain gray slacks, a white silk blouse, and low-heeled slip-ons, what her mother calls sensible shoes, Gwendy looks 10 years younger than her 37 years. She would argue vigorously with anyone who told her so, but her protests would be in vain. It was the simple truth. The elevator dings, and the doors slide open onto the third floor. Gwendy and two others sidestep their way out and join a small group of employees waiting in line at a cordoned-off security checkpoint. A burly guard, wearing a badge and sidearm, stands at the entrance, scanning identification badges. A young female guard is positioned a few yards behind him, staring at a video screen, as employees pass between the vertical slats of a walk-through metal detector. When it's Gwendy's turn at the front of the line, she pulls a laminated ID card from her leather tote bag and hands it to the guard. "Morning, Congresswoman Peterson. Busy day today?" He scans the barcode and hands it back with a friendly smile. "They're all busy, Harold." She gives him a wink. "You know that." His smile widens, exposing a pair of gold-plated front teeth. "Hey, I won't tell if you don't." Gwendy laughs and starts to walk away. From behind her, "Tell that husband of yours I said hello." She glances over her shoulder, readjusting the tote bag on her arm. "Will do. With any luck, he'll be home in time for Christmas." "God willing," Harold says, crossing himself. Then he turns to the next employee and scans his card. "Morning, Congressman." 3. Gwendy's office is spacious and uncluttered. The walls are painted a soft yellow and adorned with a framed map of Maine, a square silver-edged mirror, and a brown university pendant. Bright, warm lighting shines down on a mahogany desk centered along the opposite wall. Atop the desk are a hooded lamp, telephone, day planner, computer and keyboard, and numerous stacks of paperwork. Across the room is a dark leather sofa. A coffee table covered with fanned-out magazines sits in front of it. A small table with a coffee station stands off to one side. There's also a three-drawer filing cabinet in the far corner and a small bookshelf lined with hardcover books, knickknacks, and framed photographs. The first of the two largest photos show a tan and beaming Gwendy standing arm in arm with a handsome bearded man at the Castle Rock 4th of July parade 2 years earlier. The second is of a much younger Gwendy, standing in front of her mother and father at the base of the Washington Monument. Gwendy sits at her desk, chin resting atop interlocked hands, staring at the photograph of her and her parents instead of the report sitting open in front of her. After a moment, she sighs and closes the folder, pushing it aside. She taps a flurry of buttons on the keyboard and opens her email account. Scanning the dozens of notices in her mailbox, she stops on an email from her mother. The time code showed it was received 10 minutes earlier. She double-clicks on it, and a digital scan of a newspaper article fills her monitor screen. The Castle Rock Call, Thursday, December 16th, 1999. Still no sign of two missing girls. Despite a countywide search and dozens of tips from concerned citizens, there has been no progress in the case of two abducted Castle County girls. The latest victim, Carla Hoffman, 15, of Juniper Lane in Castle Rock, was taken from her bedroom on the evening of Tuesday, December 14th. At shortly after 6 p.m., her older brother walked across the street to visit a classmate from school. When he returned home no more than 15 minutes later, he discovered the back door open and his sister missing. "We're working around the clock to find these girls," Castle Rock Sheriff Norris Ridgwick commented. "We've brought in officers from neighboring towns and are organizing additional searches." Rhonda Tomlinson, 14, of nearby Bridgeton, vanished on her way home from school on the afternoon of Tuesday, December 7th. Gwendy frowns at the computer screen. She's seen enough. She closes the email and starts to turn away, but hesitates. Tapping at the keyboard, she switches to Saved Mail and uses the arrow button to scroll. After what feels like forever, she stops on another email from her mother, this one dated November 19th, 1998. The subject line reads, "Congratulations!" She opens it and double-clicks on a link. A small dark window with Good Morning Boston written across it opens at the center of the monitor. Then a low-resolution video comes to life, and the Good Morning Boston intro music is blaring from the computer speakers. Gwendy quickly turns down the volume. On screen, Gwendy and the popular morning show host, Della Kavanaugh, sit across from each other on straight-backed leather chairs. They each have their legs crossed and are wearing microphones clipped to their collars. A banner headline runs across the top of the video screen. Hometown girl makes good. Gwendy cringes at the sound of her voice on the video, but she doesn't turn it off. Instead, she readjusts the volume, leans back in her chair, and watches herself being interviewed, remembering how utterly strange and unsettling it felt to tell her life story to thousands of strangers. 4. After graduating from Brown in the spring of 1984, Gwendy spends the summer working a part-time job in Castle Rock before attending the Iowa Writers' Workshop in early September. For the next 3 months, she focuses on classwork and starts writing the opening chapters of what will become her first novel, a multi-generational family drama set in Bangor. When the workshop is over, she returns home to Castle Rock for the holiday, gets a tattoo of a tiny feather next to the scar on her right foot. More about that feather a little later. And begins to search for full-time employment. She receives a number of interesting offers and soon after decides on an upstart advertising and public relations firm in nearby Portland. In late January 1985, Mr. Peterson follows behind Gwendy on the interstate, pulling a U-Haul trailer full of secondhand furniture, cardboard boxes stuffed with clothes, and more shoes than any one person should own, and helps her move into a rented second-floor downtown apartment. Gwendy begins work the following week. She quickly proves to be a natural at the advertising game, and over the course of the next 18 months earns a couple of promotions. By the middle of year two, she's traveling up and down the East Coast to meet with VIP clients and is listed on company letterhead as an executive account manager. Despite her hectic schedule, the unfinished novel is never far from Gwendy's mind. She daydreams about it constantly, and pecks away at it in every nook and cranny of free time she can muster. Long flights, weekends, infrequent snow days, and the occasional weeknight when her workload allows. At a holiday work party in December 1987, her boss, making polite conversation, introduces Gwendy to an old college friend and mentions that his star employee is not only a first-class account manager, but also an aspiring author. The old friend just happens to be married to a literary agent, so he calls his wife over and introduces her to Gwendy. Relieved to have a fellow book lover to talk to, the agent takes an immediate liking to Gwendy, and by the end of the night, she convinces the aspiring author to send her the first 50 pages of her manuscript. When the second week of January rolls around, and Gwendy's phone rings one afternoon, she's shocked to find the agent on the line inquiring as to the whereabouts of those first 50 pages. Gwendy explains that she'd figured the agent was just being courteous and didn't want to add one more unpublishable book to the slush pile. The agent assures Gwendy that she's never courteous when it comes to her reading material and insists that she send it right away. So later that day, Gwendy prints the first 3 chapters of her novel, stuffs them into a FedEx overnight envelope, and sends them on their way. 2 days later, the agent calls back and asks to see the rest of the manuscript. There's only one problem. Gwendy isn't finished writing the book. Instead of admitting this to the agent, she takes the following day, a Friday, off from work, a first for Gwendy, and spends a long weekend drinking Diet Pepsi by the gallon and writing her ass off to finish the last half dozen chapters. During her lunch break on Monday, Gwendy prints the almost 300 remaining pages of the book and crams them into a FedEx box. Several days later, the agent calls and offers to represent Gwendy. The rest, as they say, is history. In April 1990, 28-year-old Gwendy Peterson's debut novel, Dragonfly Summer, is published in hardcover to rave reviews and less than impressive sales. A few months later, it wins the prestigious Robert Frost Award given annually to a work of exemplary literary merit by the New England Literary Society. This honor sells maybe, and that's a hard maybe, a few hundred extra copies, and makes for a nice cover blurb on the paperback edition. In other words, it's nothing to take to the bank. That all changes soon enough with the release of Gwendy's second book, a suburban thriller called Night Watch, published the following autumn. Stellar reviews and strong word-of-mouth sales rocket it onto the New York Times bestseller list for 4 consecutive weeks, where it rests comfortably amidst mega-sellers by Sidney Sheldon, Anne Rice, and John Grisham. The following year, 1993, sees the publication of Gwendy's third and most ambitious novel, A Kiss in the Dark, a hefty 600-page thriller set on a cruise ship. The book earns a return trip to the bestseller list, this time for 6 weeks, and soon after the film version of Night Watch, starring Nicolas Cage as the cuckolded suburban husband, hits theaters just in time for the holidays. At this point in her career, Gwendy's poised to make the leap to the big leagues of the entertainment industry. Her agent anticipates a 7-figure offer in the next book auction, and both Dragonfly Summer and A Kiss in the Dark are now deep in development by major film studios. All she has to do is stay the course, as her father likes to say. Instead, she changes direction and surprises everyone. A Kiss in the Dark is dedicated to a man named Jonathan Reardon. Years earlier, when Gwendy started working at the ad agency, it was Jonathan who took her under his wing and taught her the ropes of the advertising world. At a time when he could have easily viewed her as direct competition, especially with their proximity in age, Jonathan being only 3 years older than Gwendy, he instead befriended her and grew to become her closest ally, both in and outside the office. When Gwendy locked her keys in the car for the second time in as many days, whom did she call for help? Jonathan. When she needed serious dating advice, whom did she summon? Jonathan. The two of them spent countless evenings after work, eating Chinese food straight out of the carton and watching romantic comedies at Gwendy's apartment. When Gwendy sold her debut novel, Jonathan was the first person she told. And when she did her first book signing, he was standing at the front of the line at the bookstore. As time passed and their relationship grew closer, Jonathan became the big brother Gwendy never had but always wanted. And then he got sick, and 9 months later, he was gone. This is where the surprise enters the picture. Inspired by the AIDS-related death of her best friend, Gwendy resigns from the ad agency and spends the next 8 months writing a nonfiction memoir about Jonathan's inspiring life as a young gay man and the tragic circumstances of his passing. When she's finished, still not over the heartbreak, she immediately pours herself into directing a documentary based on Jonathan's story. Family and friends are surprised, but not surprised. Most seem to explain her newfound passion with the simple, well-worn statement, "That's just Gwendy being Gwendy." As for her agent, although she never comes right out and says it, that would be unsympathetic, not to mention unkind, she is profoundly disappointed. Gwendy had been on the fast track to stardom and had veered off to tackle a topic as controversial and unseemly as the AIDS epidemic. But Gwendy doesn't care. Someone important once told her, "You have many things to tell the world, and the world will listen." And Gwendy Peterson believes that. Eyes Closed, Jonathan's Story, is published in the summer of 1994. It garners positive reviews in Publishers Weekly and Rolling Stone, but is a slow mover in the national bookstore chains. By the end of August, it's demoted to bargain bins in the back of most stores. The similarly titled documentary is another story altogether. Released shortly after the book, the film plays to packed festival audiences and goes on to win an Academy Award for Best Documentary. Nearly 50 million viewers watch as Gwendy gives her tearful acceptance speech. She spends the majority of the next few months doing interviews with national publications and appearing on various morning and late-night talk shows. Her agent is over the moon. She's back on the fast track again and more in demand than ever before. Gwendy first meets Ryan Brown, a professional photographer from Andover, Massachusetts, during the making of the Eyes Closed documentary. The two strike up an easy friendship, and in an unforeseen turn of events for both, it grows into a relationship. On a cloudless November morning, while hiking along the banks of the Royal River near Castle Rock, Ryan pulls a diamond ring out of his backpack, gets down on a knee, and proposes. Gwendy, tears and snot streaming down her face, is so caught up in the moment she finds herself unable to utter a single word. So Ryan, ever the good sport, shifts to his other knee and asks again.
I know how much you like surprises, Gwendy. Come on, what do you say? Spend the rest of your life with me?
This time, Gwendy finds her voice. They're married the following year at her parents' church in the center of Castle Rock. The reception is held at the Castle Inn, and despite Ryan's younger brother drinking too much and breaking his ankle on the dance floor, a good time is had by all. The father of the bride and the father of the groom bond over their mutual admiration of Louis L'Amour odors, and the two mothers spend the entire day giggling like sisters. Most folks predict now that Gwendy is hitched, she'll settle down and concentrate on writing novels again. But Gwendy Peterson does love surprises, and she has one more up her sleeve. Born of simmering anger and frustration at the cruel and discriminatory manner in which many AIDS victims continue to be treated, she's particularly incensed that Congress recently voted to retain a ban on entry into the country for people living with HIV, even as more than 2.5 million AIDS cases have been reported globally. Gwendy decides, with her husband's blessing, to run for public office. Suffice to say, her agent is not pleased. Gwendy pours her heart and soul into a grassroots campaign, and it quickly catches fire. Volunteers show up in unprecedented numbers, and early fundraisers exceed all expectations. As one notoriously stingy pundit notes, Peterson, with boundless charisma and energy to match, has not only managed to mobilize the young vote and the undecided vote, she's found a way to stir the merely curious. And in a state as tradition-steeped as Maine, that may well prove to be the key to a successful fall. It turns out he's right. In November 1998, by a margin of less than 4,000 votes, Gwendy Peterson upsets incumbent Republican James Leonard for the District 1 congressional seat of Maine. The following month, just days after Christmas, she makes the move to Washington, D.C. So, there you have it. The story of how Gwendy finds herself, 11 months and 8 days, into a 2-year congressional term, peddling her idealistic ideologies, as Fox News referred to them during last night's broadcast, to anyone who will listen, and often being referred to, with a not-so-subtle hint of derision, as the celebrity congresswoman. The intercom on her desk buzzes, yanking Gwendy out of her time machine. She fumbles with the keyboard, closing the video window on her computer screen, and presses a blinking button on her telephone. Yes? Sorry to disturb, but you have a meeting with Rules and Records in 7 minutes? Thanks, B. I'll be right out. Gwendy glances at her wristwatch in disbelief. Jesus, you just wool-gathered away 45 minutes of your morning. What's wrong with you? It's a question she's asked herself a lot lately. She grabs a pair of manila folders from the top of the stack and hurries out of the office. 5. As is often the case in this corner of the world, an earlier meeting is running late, so Gwendy arrives with plenty of time to spare. Nearly 2 dozen House representatives are crammed into the narrow hallway, waiting to enter conference room C9. So she positions herself by the water cooler in the outer lobby, hoping to review her notes in private. No such luck. It's been that kind of a morning.
Forget to do your homework last night, young lady.
She clenches her jaw and looks up from the open folder. Milton Jackson, longtime representative of the state of Mississippi, is 70 years old, looks 90, and is the spitting image of what a buzzard would look like if it fluttered down from a telephone wire and slipped on a men's warehouse suit. In other words, not pretty. "Of course not," Gwendy says, offering her brightest smile. From day one at her new job, she recognized that Milton was one of those men who loathed anyone with a positive outlook on life or was simply happy. So she really turns it on. "Just doing some extra credit. And how are you this fine December morning?" The old man squints at her as if he's trying to figure out if it was a trick question.
I'm okay, he finally grumbles.
"Leave her alone, Milt," someone says from behind them. "She's young enough to be your granddaughter."
This time, Gwendy's smile is genuine as she turns to her friend. "I'd know that sweet voice anywhere. Good morning, Patsy."
"Hey, Gwenny. Is this old coot bothering you?"
Patsy Follett is in her mid-60s and as cute as she is petite. Even in the stylish high-heeled boots she's wearing, Patsy stands barely 5 feet tall. Her bobbed hair is dyed platinum, and her makeup is, shall we say, plentiful.
"No, ma'am, we were just talking strategy for today's meeting."
She looks at the congressman. "Isn't that right, Mr. Jackson?" The old man doesn't respond, just studies them from behind thick eyeglasses, like they're flying insects splattered against the windshield of his brand new Mercedes.
"Speaking of strategy," Patsy says, "you still owe me a return call on that education budget, Milt."
Yeah, he grumbles. "I'll have my secretary get back to you with a date."
Gwendy glances down at the floor and notices a piece of toilet paper stuck to the heel of one of the old man's loafers. She carefully reaches out with the tip of her shoe and nudges it free. Then she slides the toilet paper against the wall so no one else will step on it.
"Or maybe you could just pick up the phone all by yourself and call me back later today," Patsy says, arching her eyebrows.
Milton scowls and elbows his way toward the front of the crowd without so much as a goodbye. Patsy watches him go and lets out a thin whistle.
"Boy, that ugly mug of his is enough to make you want to skip breakfast. Maybe lunch, too."
Gwendy's eyes widen, and she tries to hold back a giggle. "Be nice."
"An impossibility, dear girl. I am cranky as a hornet today."
A murmur ripples through the crowd, and they finally start inching toward the entrance of the conference room.
"Guess it's that time again," Patsy says.
Gwendy puts out a hand, gesturing for her friend to go ahead of her.
"What time is that?"
Patsy smiles, and her tiny makeup-laden face lights up.
"Time to fight the good fight, of course."
Gwendy sighs and follows her friend inside. 6. 2 hours later, the door to the conference room bangs open, and 30 representatives stream out, every last one of them looking like they could use a handful of Tylenol, or at the very least, a cold shower.
"Did you see old man Henderson's face?"
Patsy asks as she and Gwendy enter the hallway.
"I thought he was going to blow a gasket right there at the podium."
"I never saw anyone get so red."
Someone bumps Gwendy hard from behind, knocking her aside and keeps on hustling past. It's their chatty friend from this morning, Milton Jackson.
"Hey, nice manners, asshole,"
Patsy calls after him. Gwendy tucks the manila folders under her arm and rubs her shoulder.
"You okay?"
"Oh, I'm fine," she says. "You shouldn't have yelled at him like that."
"Why not? The guy deserved it."
She gives Gwendy a look.
"You're not very good at losing your temper, are you?"
Gwendy shrugs. "I guess not."
"You should try it sometime. Might make you feel better."
"Fine. Next time that happens, I'll call him a walking example of why we need term limits."
"Shh," Patsy says, as they file into the elevator. "You're one of us now."
Gwendy laughs and presses the button for their floor.
"Any movement with the pharmaceutical people?"
Patsy asks. Gwendy shakes her head and lowers her voice. "Ever since Columbine, everyone has shifted to gun control and mental health. And how can I blame folks for that? I just wish people around here had longer attention spans than kindergartners. 3 months ago, I almost had the votes. Today, it's not even close." The elevator door slides open, and they walk out into a mostly empty lobby.
Welcome to the grind, girlfriend. It'll circle back around. It always does. How long have you been doing this, Patsy?
I've represented the 2nd District of the Honorable State of South Carolina for 16 years now.
Gwendy whistles.
How?
She pauses.
How do I do it?
Gwendy nods shyly. Patsy puts a hand on the young congresswoman's shoulder.
Listen, honey, I know what you're thinking. How did you get yourself into this mess? It's not even been a year, and you're frustrated and overwhelmed and looking for a way out.
Gwendy looks at her saucer-eyed.
That's not what I...
Patsy waves her off.
Trust me, we all went through it. It'll pass. You'll find your groove. And if you don't and you find your head slipping underwater, give me a call. We'll find a way to fix it together.
Gwendy leans over and hugs her friend. It's a little like embracing a child, she thinks.
Thank you, Patsy. I swear you're an angel.
I'm really not. I'm old and fussy and don't much care for most of humanity. But you're different, Gwenny. You're special.
I don't feel very special these days. But thank you again, so much.
Patsy starts to walk away, but Gwendy calls after her. You really meant it? You felt like this before? Patsy turns and puts her hands on her hips.
Honey, if I had a nickel for every time I felt the way you're feeling, I still wouldn't have change for a quarter.
Gwendy bursts out laughing.
What does that even mean?
Patsy shrugs her shoulders.
Beats me. My late husband used to say it whenever he wanted to sound clever, and it's stuck with me ever since.
7. Gwendy walks into her outer office, feeling better than she has in days. It's almost as if a weight has been lifted from her chest and she can breathe again. A gray-haired receptionist stops typing and looks up from her computer screen.
I left 2 messages on your desk, and lunch should be here soon. Turkey club and chips okay?
If Gwendy sometimes envisions, secretly, of course, she would never say these things out loud, not in a million years. Representative Patsy Follett as Tinkerbell, the wand-waving, miniature-flying guardian angel of her childhood, then she most certainly imagines her receptionist, Bea Whiteley, as Sheriff Taylor's beloved Aunt Bea from the iconic television series The Andy Griffith Show. Although there's very little physical resemblance, for starters, Gwendy's Bea is African-American, there are a multitude of other similarities. First, there's the name, of course. How many women do you know named Bea or even Beatrice? And then there's the indisputable facts. Mrs. Whiteley is a natural caregiver, an outstanding cook, a person of devoted faith, and the sweetest, most good-natured woman Gwendy has ever known. Wrap all that up into a single human being, and what do you have? Aunt Bea, that's who.
You're a lifesaver, Gwendy says. Thank you.
Bea picks up a sheet of paper from the corner of her desk.
I also printed your schedule for tomorrow.
She gets up and hands it to Gwendy. The congresswoman scans it with a frown.
Why does this feel like the last day of school before Christmas break?
Pretty sure the last day of school was a lot more fun than this.
Bea sits down at her desk again.
How's your mom feeling?
Still good as of last night. 6 weeks out from chemo, markers in the normal range.
The old lady clasps her hands together.
God is good.
Dad's driving her crazy, though. Want to hear the latest? She doesn't wait for an answer. He wants to withdraw all their savings and bury it in the backyard. He's convinced the bank's computer system's going to crash because of Y2K. Mom can't wait for him to start back at work again.
All the more reason for you to get home. You're flying out tomorrow night? Bea asks.
Gwendy shakes her head. Bumped my flight until Saturday morning. I need to wrap up a couple of things before I go. How about you? When are you and Tim headed out?
We leave Monday to visit my sister in Colorado, and from there we go to see the kids on Wednesday.
Speaking of the kids, would it be too much trouble to ask you to sign a couple of books for them?
I'm happy to pay. I'm not asking for them for free or...
Wendy puts her hand out. Will you please hush? I'd be happy to be. It'd be my pleasure.
Thank you, Mrs. Peterson. I'm very grateful.
and she looks it too, not to mention relieved. Just go and relax and enjoy that family of yours. All of us under the same roof for an entire week. It should be interesting.
It'll be a blast, Gwendy says.
B rolls her eyes. If you say so.
I say so.
She walks into her office laughing and closes the door behind her.
8. Gwendy tosses the reports back onto the stack and sits at her desk. She reaches for her day planner, but her hand freezes in midair before it gets there. There's a shiny silver coin sitting next to the keyboard. Her outstretched hand begins to tremble. Her heart thumps in her chest, and it suddenly feels as if all the air has been sucked out of the room. She knows before she looks that it's an 1891 Morgan silver dollar. She's seen them before. A familiar voice, a man's voice, whispers in her ear.
Almost half an ounce of pure silver. Created by Mr. George Morgan, who was just 30 years old when he engraved the likeness of Anna Willis Williams, a Philadelphia matron, to go on what you'd call the head side of the coin.
Gwendy whips her head around, but no one is there. She glances about her office, waiting for the voice to return, feeling as if she's just seen a ghost. And maybe she has. Nothing else in the room appears out of place. Reaching out with her other hand, she lets the tip of her index finger brush against the surface of the coin. It's cool to the touch, and it's real. She's not imagining it. She's not suffering some kind of stress-induced mental breakdown. Heart in her throat, Gwendy uses her thumb to slowly slide the coin across the desk closer to her. Then she leans down for a better look. The silver dollar is in mint condition, and she was right. It's an 1891 Morgan. Anna Williams smiles up at her with unblinking silver eyes. Pulling her hand back, Gwendy absently wipes it on the sleeve of her blouse. She gets up and slowly wanders around the room, feeling as if she's just awakened from a dream. She bangs her knee against the rounded corner of the coffee table, but she barely notices. Abruptly changing direction, she stops in front of the closet door, the only place where someone could possibly hide. After taking a steadying breath, she silently counts to 3 and yanks open the door. She recoils with her hands held in front of her face, nearly falling, but there's no one waiting inside. Just a handful of coats and sweaters hanging on wire hangers, a tangle of dress and running shoes littering the floor, and a brand new pair of snow boots still in the box. Exhaling with relief, Gwendy pushes the door shut and turns to face her desk again. The silver coin sits there, gleaming in the overhead lights, staring back at her. She's about to call for B when something catches her eye. She crosses to the filing cabinet in the corner. A bronze bust of Maine Civil War hero Joshua Chamberlain sits on top of it, a gift from her father. Gwendy pulls open the top drawer of the cabinet. It's stuffed with folders and assorted paperwork. She closes it. Then she does the same with the second drawer. Slides it open, quick inspection, close. Holding her breath, she bends to a knee and pulls open the bottom drawer. And there it is, the button box. A beautiful mahogany, the wood glowing a brown so rich that she can glimpse tiny red glints deep in its finish. It's about 15 inches long, maybe a foot wide and half that deep. There are a series of small buttons on top of the box, 6 in rows of 2, and a single at each end, 8 in all. The pairs are light green and dark green, yellow and orange, blue and violet. One of the end buttons is red, the other is black. There's also a small lever at each end of the box, and what looks like a slot in the middle. For a moment, Gwendy forgets where she is. Forgets how old she is. Forgets that a kind and gentle man named Ryan Brown was ever born. She's 12 years old again, crouching in front of her bedroom closet back in the small town of Castle Rock, Maine. It looks exactly the same, she thinks. It looks the same because it is the same. There's no mistaking it even after all these years. From behind her, there's a loud knock at the door. Gwendy almost faints.
9. Are you okay, Congresswoman? I was knocking for a long time.
Gwendy steps back from the door and lets her receptionist into the office. Bee's carrying a small tray with the turkey club lunch on it. She places it on the desk and turns back to her boss. If Bee notices the silver coin sitting next to the keyboard, she doesn't mention it.
I'm fine, Gwendy says. Just a little embarrassed. I was doing some reading and I guess I dozed off.
Must have been some dream you were having. It sounded like you were whimpering.
You don't know the half of it, Gwendy thinks.
You sure you're okay? Bee asks. If you don't mind my saying, you look a little rattled and a lot pale. Almost like you've seen a ghost.
Bingo again, Gwendy thinks and almost bursts out giggling.
I went for a longer than usual run this morning and haven't had much to drink. I'm probably just dehydrated.
The receptionist gives her a long look, clearly unconvinced.
I'll go grab a couple more waters then. I'll be right back.
She turns and heads out of the office.
Bee?
She stops in the doorway and turns back.
Did anyone stop by the office when I was at my meeting this morning?
Bee shakes her head.
No, ma'am.
You certain?
Yes, ma'am.
She looks around the room.
Is something wrong? Do you need me to call security?
No, no, Gwendy says, escorting the older lady the rest of the way out of the room. But maybe you should call a doctor, since I can't seem to stay awake past lunchtime these days.
Bee once again offers a faint smile, not very convincingly, and hurries off. Gwendy closes the door and walks a direct line back to the filing cabinet. She knows she doesn't have much time. Bending to a knee again, she slides open the bottom drawer. The button box is still there, practically sparkling in the overhead lights, waiting for her. Gwendy reaches out with both hands and hesitates, her fingers hovering an inch or two above its highly polished surface. She feels the hairs on her arms begin to tingle, hears the faint whisper of something in the far corner of her brain. Steeling herself, she carefully lifts the box out of the drawer. And as she does, it all rushes back to her.
10.
When Gwendy was a young girl, her father hauled the old cardboard box marked slides out of the attic every summer, usually sometime around the 4th of July. He set up his ancient slide projector on the coffee table in the den, positioned the pull-down screen in front of the fireplace, and turned off all the lights. He always made a big deal of the experience. Mom made popcorn and a pitcher of fresh lemonade. Dad narrated every slide with what he called his Hollywood voice and made shadow puppets during intermission. Gwendy usually sat on the sofa between her mother and father, but sometimes other neighborhood kids would join them, and on those occasions she sat on the floor in front of the screen with her friends. Some of the kids grew bored quickly and made up excuses to leave.
Oops, I'm sorry, Mr. Peterson. I just remembered I promised my mom I'd clean my room tonight.
But Gwendy was never one of them. She was fascinated by the images on the screen, and even more so by the stories those images told. As Gwendy's fingers close around the button box for the first time in 15 years, it's as if a slideshow of vibrant, flickering images, each one telling its own secret story, blooms in front of her eyes. Suddenly it's August 22, 1974, and a strange man in a black coat and a small, neat black hat is reaching under a Castleview Park bench and sliding out a canvas bag with a drawstring top. He pulls it open and removes the most beautiful mahogany box. An early September morning, and Gwendy stands in front of her bedroom closet dressing for school. When she's finished, she slips a tiny piece of chocolate into her mouth and closes her eyes in ecstasy. Middle school, as Gwendy stares at herself in a full-length dressing room mirror and realizes she isn't just pretty, she's gorgeous, and no longer wearing eyeglasses.
sophomore year of high school, and she's sitting on the den sofa staring in horror as images of bloated, fly-covered corpses fill the television screen. Late at night, the house graveyard quiet, and she's sitting cross-legged in the dark on her bed with the button box resting in her lap, eyes squeezed tight in concentration, using her thumb to press the red button, and then cocking her head at the open window, listening for the rumble. A mild spring evening, and she's screaming hysterically as two teenaged boys crash into her night table, sending hairbrushes and makeup skittering across the bedroom floor before reeling into the open closet, falling and pulling down dresses and skirts and pants from their plastic hangers, collapsing to the ground in a heap, and then a filthy hand with blue webbing tattooed across the back of it lifts the button box and brings it crashing down, corner first, into the crown of her boyfriend's skull. Gwendy gasps, and she's back in Washington, D.C., and without a moment to spare. She scrambles across her office floor on all fours and vomits into the wastebasket next to her desk.